Thanks everyone for coming. My name is Dan. I'm Associate Director at the Office for Research, Ethics and Integrity, and it's a pleasure to have you all here, and it's a pleasure to have Brett here with us today. Brett is a linguist who has been studying Indigenous languages of Australia firsthand in remote parts of Arnhem Land for around 20 years. He has a current ARC grant looking at the new language of Creole, and that's now the largest Indigenous language in the country. Brett, it's a pleasure to have you. Thank you very much for delivering your talk, Ethical Guidelines for Researchers Working with Aboriginal Communities. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for coming along. So I presume that you're here because you want to know something more about how to start working with Aboriginal communities, or you already do and you want to know something more about the ethical considerations involved. So I'm going to spend quite a bit of time talking about what it's like to work in an Aboriginal community, particularly the remote parts of the country that I've got more experience with. I know that not everyone works in those kinds of areas. Lots of people do work in more regional areas as well. I won't have as much to say about those, although a lot of the ethical considerations that I'm considering here are just as applicable to those communities as to the remote ones. So this is the kind of stuff I'm going to go through. I'm going to talk firstly about why it's important to do research with Aboriginal people in the first place. Why bother? Then we're going to talk about some very, very briefly about some broad ethical considerations, even not going into the actual policy that the universities follow at present. Just what are some broad humanitarian concerns about doing this kind of research? Then this is the boring part of the talk, going through the actual policy documents, the stuff that's really relevant to know. I'll say briefly what I look for when an ethics application comes to our committee at the university and it involves research with Aboriginal people. What kind of things do I look for in that application? What are the kinds of flags that are raised in some cases? Then I'll spend quite a bit of time talking about how you get into working with an Aboriginal community in the first place if you don't have this kind of experience already. How many of you do, by the way? How many of you already work in these kinds of communities? Okay, so not all that many. And then what you can expect from working in those places, what kinds of things to look out for, some common pitfalls, some ways that you can maximise your research return, if you like. And then I'm going to finish with this question: what can Aboriginal people benefit from research? If you've got questions along the way, just stop me if things don't make sense. So what I do is academic linguistics. It involves recording, analysing, and to some extent providing useful materials as a kind of payback for working with Aboriginal people. I also provide advice to people like the Department of Education on Aboriginal language matters to some extent. Mostly what I work on is the traditional languages, so-called. So these are the languages that were present at the time of first contact with Europeans and others. Please work. Okay. I'll try this the old-fashioned way. This is about the only kind of snazzy technology you'll see in this PowerPoint presentation, which is probably why it didn't work. Okay, so this is a nifty map of languages of Australia. How do I get across? As you can see, the entire continent was claimed by Aboriginal groups. There were no parts that were unclaimed. There are no wilderness areas as far as Aboriginal people are concerned. They all belong to some Aboriginal group or other. Some of those groups are very large, obviously the ones that are in the desert areas here. Others were extremely small, like the group that I'm going to be talking about here, the Noongabuyu, which really occupied a very tiny area of coastal land. Extremely small area. but incredibly rich in natural resources. So the area where I did most of my work was in the basin of the Roper River, originally working on these languages, most of which are now extinct, no longer spoken actively by really anyone as a first language. So these days I do most of my work at Noongar on the Rose River mouth, just north of the Roper River. It's a small settlement, like most remote settlements of Aboriginal people. It's only got a couple of hundred people, a very small airstrip. The barge landing that brings the supplies to the community, especially during the wet season, is essential. And the main language spoken in this community is no longer the traditional language, Wuboi or Noongarboyu. That's spoken really only by people over the age of 55. This is very common in remote Australia. And everyone younger than that uses another language as their main vernacular language. That language is called Creole. So Creole is a new Aboriginal language. It's not a traditional language in the usual sense. It's a language that developed out of contact between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people from the time of first settlement in the Sydney area. It developed from a kind of pidgin, a simplified version of English. And that was carried north with the pastoral industry into Queensland and then across into the Northern Territory and Western Australia in the latter part of the 19th century. At some point after that, children started speaking Creole as their first language. They started acquiring it and turning it into a much more complicated language than it had been originally. So it was no longer a pidgin anymore. It was a fully blown language that started off as a pidgin, still has most of its vocabulary drawn from English, but is quite different to it. It's not mutually intelligible with English anymore. And it's heavily influenced by the traditional languages, both in the sound system and in the grammar. As you can see there, Creole occupies a much bigger area than any other traditional language, and has a much greater number of speakers. 20,000 people is the estimate for the first language speakers of Creole. So it's bigger by an order of magnitude than any traditional language. The biggest ones of those are about 2,000 speakers, and probably were always no bigger than that. Many of them are much smaller than that, and probably always were. So the project that Dan mentioned at the start is an attempt to understand how Creole works, because this is the language of so many children across Northern Australia. It's the language that they start school with. And the question is, when they are exposed to English at school and need to learn English, learn to read it, to write it, and to speak and understand it, how does being a Creole speaker influence that process? Does it help them, or does it make it more difficult? That's an open question. It could be either way. And that's a long-term research question that we have to understand how being a Creole speaker can influence your development of English. So that's just a little bit about what I do. Now I'll come back to what I said I was going to talk about, which is ethical considerations in doing research. So the first thing that I said I'd talk about was the importance of doing this kind of research. And the kind of research that I do is important because we hope that it will lead to a better outcome for Aboriginal children who are faced with the education system, using a language that they don't necessarily understand very well. Why bother doing this kind of research? A lot of people seem to think that it's too difficult to do research with Aboriginal people. I don't think that's the case. It takes a little more care, a little more forethought and planning in a lot of cases than working with members of your own ethnic community, but it is by no means impossible. For one thing, ATSI people, so Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander peoples, represent an important clinical, psychological, / behavioural and anthropological minority. If you want to understand how human beings work, then you need to take account of ethnic minorities like that. So from the point of view of linguistics, for instance, we can't hope to arrive at a reasonable understanding of human language without understanding about Aboriginal languages as well. And what we know so far from doing this kind of work over about 40 to 50 years is that Aboriginal languages are a challenging minority in terms of the way their languages behave. They have quite a number of serious differences from better known languages in Europe. And those can challenge the ways that we understand how language is structured in the brain, for instance. Now, apart from these sort of broad, pure research aims, there are also many applied aims which are quite significant in a lot of cases, and this is one of them. So the Closing the Gap initiative from 2008 from the Council of Australian Governments was a recognition by the Rudd government that there were serious discrepancies in the outcomes for Indigenous people as opposed to non-Indigenous people in Australia. And these were the kinds of targets that they were aiming for in this initiative. I won't go through all of them. But, for instance, this is the one that we have in mind when we do this work on Creole, me and my collaborators. So, from one perspective, research on Aboriginal people or with Aboriginal people is an important way to reduce the disadvantage that they experience. And for lots of Aboriginal people that you may come into contact with, there is an expectation that the kind of research you do is going to lead to reducing this kind of disadvantage that is quite apparent to them as well. Now, I said I'd talk about some broad ethical considerations, not even looking at policy so much, but just from a humanitarian perspective. Firstly, there's the right to be left in peace and quiet. Not everyone necessarily wants a bunch of eggheads knocking down their door, asking them difficult questions for long periods of time. Everyone's got the right to be left alone and to not participate in that kind of research. The reason why ethics committees in Australia always have to consider full applications if they involve Aboriginal people is because Aboriginal people have been subjected to more research per capita than non-Indigenous people in Australia. And a lot of that research has been quite invasive historically and still continues to be in some cases. And that's why ethics committees take our job fairly seriously when it comes to Aboriginal people. We need to know what are the risks and the benefits. Is this really the kind of research that's worth doing? Will it lead to some kind of benefit for Aboriginal people? Are they likely to be exposed to some kind of risk that they need not be exposed to? Now, you may be thinking, well, surely these people are adults. They've got the ability to say yes or no. Why do we have to treat Aboriginal people like a special group, almost like children or intellectually disabled groups who also need special care? And the reason is partly because of this overemphasis in the research culture on Aboriginal people. The other reason is that there's a particular way of interacting in many Aboriginal societies that can lead to gratuitous concurrence. And this is a well-understood phenomenon, that Aboriginal people are quite sort of likely to say yes if you ask them to do something, even if they don't particularly want to do it, just to make you feel happy. This can put them into serious trouble with the police, for instance, and has led to things like incarceration and false arrests, false confessions. So this is the kind of thing that's been taken account of in the law to some extent, but it's part of the reason why we don't just let researchers run around asking people to work with them. I've already mentioned benefit versus risk. You need to weigh up what is going to be the benefit to Aboriginal people if you do this research. Sometimes those benefits may be long-term. I'll talk about those down the track. Sometimes they're very short-term benefits, like the chance of employment. Sometimes they're medium-term benefits, like improving outcomes in some observable domain. You need to weigh those up against the risk. And one of those risks is this one here, the right to be left in peace and quiet. Is this really worth doing? Is it going to lead to some kind of advance for us? Another consideration, I take this asthma medication, which has the very useful byproduct of deleting all my stressed bowels. And I need to kind of think to control it. So another consideration is what happens with your research. It's very important to Aboriginal people to maintain control over traditional knowledge. I'll come back to this at a bit of a later stage. But you need to take this into account, that what you find out, especially if it involves traditional knowledge like language, performance, art, music, ceremonies, knowledge over land resources like plants, needs to be, you need to consider that this kind of knowledge is regarded as knowledge that belongs to that local group and that they have a right to maintain control over that knowledge. You need to consider seriously the idea of having research partnerships. I'll come back to that as well, because these are all part of a new set of proposals that I'm going to talk about. So the national policies that govern research involving Aboriginal people are these ones here, essentially. Particularly the first two. So the National Health Medical Research Council has a number of official documents that govern the ways that human research ethics committees do their job and how they evaluate proposals. I'll talk about those briefly. The Australian Institute of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies also has a policy document on carrying out research ethically and responsibly with Aboriginal people. I won't be going through that in detail. The Australia Council for the Arts has one that applies specifically to performance, working with performance and artworks, products of artistic endeavour. And this is one that I will say something about. This is a new proposal, which is hopefully going to be adopted by the ARC. I'll release these slides to the ethics mob so that you can download them at a later stage. So no need to go crazy scribbling. So these are the three most relevant NHMRC documents. There's the National Statement, which just governs ethics in general. It has a couple of pages on research with Aboriginal people. And then there are a couple of publications that are specifically to do with working with Aboriginal people. And they're really written from the point of view of Aboriginal communities rather than Whitefellow researchers. So they're very useful to look at, I think. This is the IATSIS document. You can download it for yourself and have a look. This is the Council for the Arts one. The National Statement involves two pages, like I said. What they say there, this is one of the quotes, is that the cornerstone of an ethical research relationship with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples is respect for and valuing of cultural and language diversity. And what I'm going to repeat quite a number of times in this talk is this word respect. I think this is like the central value that you should keep in mind when considering research with Aboriginal people. It can really cover all sorts of other kinds of behaviours and outcomes. This document, Values in Ethics, I've identified six core values that it says are important to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities: reciprocity, respect, equality, responsibility, survival and protection, and spirit and integrity. So reciprocity is to do with the idea that if you want something, then be prepared to give something back. This is at a cornerstone of an organising principle in Aboriginal society, which is kinship obligations, which I'll come back to. But it's a way that many Aboriginal people see the kind of research endeavour as a kind of exchange. And you should give some thought about this when you're designing a project. How can you give back to the community in a way that will make sense? Respect is very important. I've mentioned that already. Equality means the right to be treated fairly, like anybody else in the community. Responsibility means taking responsibility for your actions. If you're doing something that can lead to risks, then you need to consider those risks and you need to be prepared to face the consequences if things turn out badly. Survival and protection refer to the survival of Aboriginal knowledge and ways of living. And the responsibility that members of the community have to protect those ways of knowledge and ways of living. Spirit and integrity refer to approaching research in a kind of honest way, not trying to cover things up, not trying to pull the wool over anybody's eyes. So I mentioned that the national guidelines on ethics require that anything that involves Aboriginal participants as a targeted group, not as an accidental kind of member of your group of participants, but as a targeted participant group, has to involve full assessment. It can't just be vetted at a local level by your school or faculty. So it can't be deemed minimum risk. And I've talked about the reasons for that already. That means it has to be assessed by, according to the national statement, either by people who have networks with Aboriginal people. And often I'm going to say Aboriginal in this talk, where I really mean Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander. Or who are familiar with the group that is named in the research application itself, or who have relevant ongoing knowledge of Aboriginal societies that can give advice. Now, this is the new policy document that I mentioned. It's called Indigenous Linguistic and Cultural Heritage, and I'm going to look at this in a little bit more detail because I think it has some interesting proposals which go a bit further than the existing documents, are a bit more specific in a lot of ways in how researchers can manage the things that they need to manage in order to come up with a project that's going to work for Aboriginal people as well as for them. It's been developed by the ARC Centre of Excellence for the Dynamics of Language, which has a branch here at Melbourne Uni and is, I believe, going to be adopted by the ARC in due course as its general kind of set of guidelines for doing research with Aboriginal people. So here's an important quote from that document, which also mentions the NHMRC. The COE acknowledges that simply adhering to institutional requirements does not entail an ethical outcome. You can tick all the boxes, do everything that's required of you in the guidelines, and still not have a project that is ethical in the way that Aboriginal people expect it to be. Which means that you can get into big trouble. The least of which is that people will just not talk to you anymore, and your project will die an untimely death. So the guidelines advanced here, and this is really referring to values and ethics, the one that's written from the Aboriginal point of view, is more demanding because it seeks to move from compliance to trust. Okay, it's not just simply a matter of ticking the boxes. You need to achieve trust. And I'll come back to that right at the end. There's a special focus in this document on particular kinds of research which won't all be relevant. I won't go through that in detail. It refers to the Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which includes things like the fact that Indigenous people expect to maintain intellectual property rights over their traditional cultural expressions, including knowledge about country, artistic expression, language, and so on. These are the specific proposals, which I don't really have time to go into in great detail, but it emphasises developing research questions and projects in such a way that you take account of the kinds of things that will lead to a good outcome. So taking account of things like reciprocity and some of these other things that are mentioned. So one of those things is considering a research agreement. This won't always be necessary or even achievable, but where it's possible and where both sides think it's a good idea, it can be a good thing to do. Make some kind of agreement about intellectual property, about the products of your research, about what the expectations are on both sides. It's important to consider this. I mentioned this before, that think seriously about developing a collaborative research team, one that involves both researchers and local Aboriginal people involved in the research project in some way. I've done this, and it's an extremely good thing to do. It's a good way of giving back to the community. It's a good way of developing skills and knowledge on both sides, and can promote pride and respect. You need to compensate people for their time. It's widely expected in Aboriginal parts of the country that people will be compensated in some way for time that they give up. You need to negotiate those compensations and take advice from local organisations on that. Do it in advance, otherwise you can risk some serious ill feeling if people aren't compensating where they are expected to be. I'll come back to interpreters and consent and some of these other things a little bit later on. This other stuff that they propose is really to do with the use of, well, really to do with archiving records and using those archival records and who has access and so on. This one here is important. So for me, it's quite important to keep people updated on your research project as it carries through. Tell them what your ongoing results are. Tell them why it's relevant to them. Tell them what you found out, how this can impact on the way that they teach things at school, for instance, if it's a language-related issue, for instance. Think about not just sending them your latest article, but some kind of digestible version of it that will make sense to local people, that can be pinned up at the local shop, for instance, to explain what your project is about. One advantage of doing that is that you're likely to gain more interest. You're likely to get more people interested in working with you. Okay, these are some of the specific proposals in the Centre of Excellence document that are a bit different to the national guidelines. There are more specific sets of suggestions about how to run your research project that go a bit beyond the sort of broad-based stuff in the national statements. There's an emphasis on the need to constantly renegotiate with Aboriginal communities. Don't expect that having an agreement that was established 5 years ago is necessarily going to do you any good today. You need to keep on negotiating. There needs to be a two-way exchange. You need to be prepared to give back. I've already mentioned this. And in essence, a lot of this stuff comes down to having respect for the people you work with. What do I look for when I get an application at the Ethics Committee that I work at here at Melbourne Uni? The primary thing I look for first is evidence of established ties with the community. If a researcher has these, and it seems fair dinkum to me, then I'm much more happy to let it go forward, as long as the research, balances benefits and risks and ticks all the other boxes. Because this, to me, tells me that apart from the human ethics protocol, it means that people in the community where these people are working are happy to have them back. And that's the number one test for me that this is a researcher who is doing the right thing by people. Because otherwise, people would not be welcome. But not everyone has this kind of setup already. People who are new to this kind of research, either new researchers or people who haven't done this kind of research before, won't be able to do this. So what can they do? You can talk about existing networks. So sometimes people set up a steering committee that involves Aboriginal staff at the university or wherever they work or some other institution to act as intermediaries between the researcher and the community where they want to work, and that can be quite useful. Or someone else, some individual who can provide that kind of role. Barring access to those kinds of people, it can be extremely useful to work through a local Aboriginal organisation, like a traditional owners corporation, a land council, a local Aboriginal health organisation, a local language centre. All of these can provide researchers with the ability to make initial contact with communities that they want to work with. And that's essentially how I started working with Aboriginal people, was through a local Aboriginal language centre. It would be good, in many cases, to see some evidence of involvement of local people, or at least I want to see evidence that researchers have thought about this as a possibility, to pay local people to do work for the project in some way. And I needed to see a consideration of the benefits and the risks. Is this really something that is worth the time of Aboriginal people to be involved in. So if you don't already have access to a community, how do you start? I've already talked about this a little bit, and I'm starting to run out of time, scarily enough. Working with Aboriginal organisations is a very good way to do this. I've already mentioned some of these. So Aboriginal language centres don't just manage language, they also manage a lot of Indigenous knowledge documentation, including things like knowledge about country. They also act as kinds of local archives of recordings, and they manage a lot of local education. So they're good places to get to know if you're working in a part of the country that has one of these organisations. Ranger organisations are also extremely useful in this regard. They mainly do natural resource management in remote parts of the country, but again, they manage a lot of traditional knowledge, and they act as a kind of intermediary between researchers and the community quite frequently. Then there's the local research unit at Melbourne University. These contacts are all at the end of the slides. Personal contacts are really invaluable. If you're planning to work with an Aboriginal community, the last thing you want to do is just stroll in off the airplane and start introducing yourself to people. That's probably the worst approach. The best approach, really, is to go there with someone who is known well to the community already, preferably a local. But if not, then a researcher who already knows the place and can introduce you to people. Ideally, that's the best way to go. If you don't know a community, then talk to your academic contacts. A lot of them will have worked in Aboriginal communities or know someone who has, who can set you up with someone who can help you out in a lot of cases. But you can't just walk in. You need permission to enter Aboriginal land as designated by the Commonwealth. That's provided by the Aboriginal Land Councils, the NLC and so on. But even if somewhere is not designated Aboriginal land, like a community in Victoria, for instance, not all of those are Aboriginal land, but some of them are, you still need permission. How do you get that? You need to approach someone who is a local, who is authorised to give you permission to enter the community. In places like Victoria, you can approach the traditional owners' corporations and, just as a courtesy, give them a call and discuss your research project with them and ask for permission to go there and start talking to people. If you need to work in Aboriginal lands, then you need a research permit. You can't just use a visitor permit. And you'll be asked questions about whether you have ethical clearance already and whether you've considered intellectual property rights. Now, it can be quite a long process to get a research permit. Sometimes they never arrive from the Northern Land Council, and there are ways around this. You are technically able to approach traditional owners yourself and ask for permission, but you still need to ring ahead and advise someone that you're coming out. It's extremely bad form not to do that. You can't just rock up. Often when you start working in a community initially, your first contact will be with people who have been called brokers in the anthropological literature. These are Aboriginal and also non-Aboriginal people who often act as cultural intermediaries for a number of reasons. Often that's because of genuine ability to negotiate in two spheres. And so they can be extremely skilled in doing that, and extremely useful to non-Aboriginal people. But eventually you probably want to go beyond those people and start working with other members of the community, and you need to negotiate that move delicately. Now, what to expect? And here I'm mostly going to be talking about remote parts of the country rather than regional areas, but a lot of these things still apply even to the regional areas. So I'll talk about, in the 2 minutes I have left, cultural considerations, language issues, life in remote townships, and local whitefellas. So in a lot of remote settlements, and also in more nearby ones as well, life is still governed in a fairly traditional way to, you know, greater or lesser extents, depending on where you are. And that includes expectations about the ways that people can behave and should behave. Traditional Aboriginal society is quite conservative and quite governed by rules of etiquette, ways of behaving. Some of those can seem quite foreign if you don't have experience of them already. Social relationships are basically almost entirely governed by kinship to a greater or lesser extent. Particularly in remote areas, it's almost entirely governed by kinship. And those things are much more important to the vast majority of Aboriginal people, even in nearby areas to Melbourne, than other kinds of relationships like friendship or work alliances. Kinship ties are much more important. Apart from that, kinship really is at the core of all sorts of other ways of understanding Aboriginal society. So ceremonial obligations, rights to land, ways that you hook up with other people, rights and obligations to share resources, including food, with other people, and the organisations of groups for particular purposes, even short-term purposes, like going out to collect firewood, are governed by kinship. In traditional communities, but even ones that aren't so remote, the kinship ties aren't just biological ties, they're social ties. Everyone that you know in a community is one of your kin. Okay, and those things are determined socially. I won't go into the details of how that works, but basically everyone has a kin relationship to you. And that determines how you can behave with each other. Why is that relevant? Because in Aboriginal communities where you work, kinship will be at the heart of all of the social organisation. And it also governs things like the likelihood that two individuals will work with you or with each other, for instance. So understanding how kinship works is fundamental to understanding how the society works. It pays to try and come to grips with this thing. Often if you hang around long enough, you'll be adopted into the kinship network, if you regard it as important enough. That has benefits and drawbacks. You should take that relationship seriously, but not too seriously, depending on how willing you are to truly become a part of that system. Interactions, particularly in remote areas, can be a very frustrating experience for whitefellas because interactive style can be quite different to what you expect. And it doesn't just come down to language. Language is often an issue in remote parts of the country. In those places, most people don't speak English as a first language. Many people speak it quite poorly and will have a lot of trouble understanding you. Don't just expect that people will understand what you say, particularly if you use technical words. So in those areas, there's some other kind of language, which is the local vernacular, either traditional languages or contact languages like Creole or some, you know, combination of those. For that reason, it's often important to have an interpreter. You need to make sure that people are understanding what you're saying and what you want to do. You will also need them to interpret for you what people say back to you. Even if it's English, then you'll often miss a lot of what they're trying to say to you just because you're not familiar with that kind of English that they're speaking. They can also help you to avoid making serious missteps, social missteps. And for that reason, I usually go around with offsiders from the local community. Literacy levels can be extremely low in remote parts of Australia. So can general knowledge about the ways that whitefellas do stuff. The ways that universities carry out research can be a complete mystery to Aboriginal people in remote parts of the country. You know, why are you doing this stuff? Interactive style can also be quite different. This applies to many parts of the country, not just the remote areas. You can't necessarily ask direct questions. You won't always get an answer to a question if you ask someone. It's perfectly legitimate for people to just ignore you. There's no requirement to answer direct questions. It's important to be polite. That means being indirect. Not singling people out for special attention is a way of doing that. You need to be careful of hearsay. Hearsay can come across like truth. In many areas, relationships between the sexes are much more restricted. You can't, if you're a man, just walk up to a woman in the community and start talking to her. If you're a man, then you should expect to work mainly with men. And likewise, if you're a woman, you can expect to work mainly with women, with some exceptions to do with old people and kids. When you first start working, you'll often be directed to old people. Don't take this as a brush off. Old people are often seriously respected in Aboriginal communities for the knowledge that they have. Okay, depending on what kind of work you're doing, don't ignore these people. On the other hand, you may find it very difficult to talk to young people. They may just avoid you like the plague. So there are expectations about the ways that people behave. These are particularly true of women. In many places, you're expected to dress demurely, not to behave in certain ways, and so on. I won't go into those details. You need to be prepared to be cut off or to have access to your chosen community cut off during the wet season. Life during the build-up areas in northern Australia can be extremely uncomfortable. Okay, I won't talk much about that. And I won't say much about local whitefellas, except don't expect much help from them. For whatever reason. Now, how can Aboriginal people gain from research? So I mentioned this back at the beginning. So many researchers have, you know, sometimes often vague hopes that their research will lead to long-term benefits for Aboriginal people in terms of health, education, employment outcomes, and so on. And sometimes you can demonstrate, you know, movements towards those improved outcomes. And those are important to Aboriginal people that I've talked to. Don't discount them. There are also lots of short-term benefits. And one of the most concrete of those is employing people in your research team, which I've mentioned before, in whatever capacity. Take that seriously. There are also the intangibles. It's important for many Aboriginal people to be seen to be taken seriously by white fellow culture. It means that their knowledge is being valued. And that has flow-on effects for the rest of the community. It means that kids will suddenly look at their elders' language with more respect. You know, look, here's this white fella. He thinks it's really interesting. Okay, so I'm almost done. Don't take the involvement or interest of Aboriginal people in your research project for granted. You need to work for that interest. And you need to build up trust with the community that you want to work with if you want to get the best kind of outcome from your project. Building up that kind of trust is going to take time and effort on your part. It's going to take a lot of diplomacy and negotiation and conciliation as well. But the rewards can be extremely large on many levels, not just academic, but also personal. I can't stress enough the importance of mutual respect in carrying out this kind of work. You can't treat anything as impersonal when you're working in an Aboriginal community. Everything has potential personal ramifications. And that means that a lot of the people you work with will be very important friends to you, not just research collaborators. They will treat this as an important kind of kinship relation, and you need to think about that. And that's all I have to say.
Sharing your experiences and knowledge in this really important area. I'll open up the floor to some questions, please. Welcome questions.
The NHS has recently released a report.
RC. Yep.
It says at one point that all important Indigenous knowledge should be kept forever.
So the current ethics protocols here say that you should keep data recorded as part of your project for a minimum of 5 years, and then you need to say whether you're going to destroy it or not. Now, often when people are working with Indigenous knowledge, they say that it will be kept in perpetuity, and that's partly to address the expressed wishes of Aboriginal communities, which is that researchers assist in protecting and conserving that knowledge, and also making it available by putting it in archives and making it available for download for communities for future generations. So I think that's definitely the default position if you're working with Aboriginal people in anything that has to do with their knowledge. Does that answer your question?
It does. It does have some implications in terms of the frameworks and ongoing management in terms of access and stuff.
Absolutely. So I haven't talked about that, and this is a huge and complicated area. So one of the things that has recently changed here at Melbourne Uni is that now the university expects your data to be accessible and to be to be able to be searched by other researchers and validated and so on. And this raises all sorts of problematic issues. So it's not just that Aboriginal people want their knowledge to be conserved, they also want it to be, in some cases, protected from outside viewing. So they don't necessarily want everybody to have access to their stories, songs, artwork, even snippets of language that aren't particularly traditional or anything like that. And this is something that researchers have to negotiate, and it has to take priority over the university's wishes for data to be freely accessible, I think. That's my view, anyway.
I've seen examples of the centres of excellence with the linguistics. They've got very advanced data management processes and resources. The key one being dedicated people who are experts in data management. It's really the only way to do it.
So one way to deal with this is to set up levels of access or to to manage access in such a way that you can gatekeep who gets access. But again, these things need to be often renegotiated. You can't take the word of one person that you worked with in the 1970s as necessarily being the current community position on this. So it can be very tricky. Yeah, I mean, a lot of the linguistic work I did, particularly early on, wasn't particularly relevant. What was relevant was returning things like educational materials to the community I was working with. So making booklets for kids, working on a dictionary project, working on booklets of, plant names and things like that. And that's a perfectly valid way of giving, of participating in exchange. It doesn't have to be exactly what you're working on.
Exactly.
It just has to be something that's relevant and useful.
A lot of the ethics requirements would ask that we have explanatory papers and a plain language guide, but some of the people we're going to be working with will not have literacy.
Yep.
How do you tackle that? Do you have an explanatory checklist?
Thanks for bringing that up, actually. That was something that I meant to mention and I didn't get to. So one of these things here was ensuring informed consent. Now, I mentioned that people in a lot of areas don't have good literacy, and even if they do, they don't necessarily understand what they're talking about if you read an information sheet to them. So it's perfectly valid to gain informed consent orally by explaining something to people and recording your explanation in whatever language, whether it's simple English or whether you have it translated, interpreted into a local vernacular on the spot or in advance, and recording people's acknowledgement that they understand what you're saying, that they agree to participate on these conditions, that they understand that they can withdraw at any time without any, you know, negative consequences, and so on. The kinds of things that you need to get in a consent form. There's no problem with doing that.
I'm just wondering, I mean, obviously this is mainly centered around, or coming from the point of view of linguistics and language, but I wonder how it expands and probably modifies when you're looking at other types of research, and I'm thinking broadly of research into social problems. And the difference here is that this idea that research ought to be subordinated to the idea of consent, and that research shouldn't be occurring without the consent, or should be serving a purpose that's subjectively understood within a community, potentially interferes with a different priority, which is getting to what you might call the truth of the matter in relation to something that community members don't actually want you to know. So if you're going in and you're trying to research something like abuse or violence or contraband, these sorts of things, and potentially the people who are your chosen informants have reasons to not want you to know certain things, then you've got a very complex landscape there.
Sure.
You're trying to come in and research something on the assumption that you need consent, which is not going to be forthcoming or will be silently qualified to serve the interests of certain people. So how do you get around that?
Okay, firstly, I don't think this question is necessarily relevant to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities as such, or as a particular group. So I mentioned at the start that we get ethics applications come before us if they are targeting Aboriginal participants specifically. And the kind of thing you're talking about doesn't strike me as something that is necessarily specific to Aboriginal people. So then you want to justify why you wanted to work on these problems in Aboriginal communities in particular. But secondly, if you're doing any kind of research that is going to have people who've been involved in criminal activity at risk of revealing themselves, then you're entering a whole other ethics ballgame, which I'm not really qualified to speak about. I mean, you could ask the current chair of the Ethics Committee over there, Paul Gruber, for instance. But in that case, and really this is taking me beyond what I wanted to talk about, I guess, which is that you're asking people to talk about stuff that they shouldn't have to talk about necessarily and may not want to talk about, like you say. And then do you have the right to ask them questions? Well, under the current ethics protocols, no, not necessarily. So you need to think about another way of doing what you want to do.
Just quickly, as the chair of that committee, 13 people are on that committee. So we have a priest, a lawyer, 4 people from the community, 4 or 5 academics around the entire university. So it's 13 people are looking at that application. All 13 people read them, and then we have about 4 to 5 signatures on all of those applications. So back to the legal issues, it would probably involve, for example, Brett with his Aboriginal knowledge, but we'd also get a law academic and also a lawyer from the community, and potentially a psychologist. So it's that level of scrutiny across, and that's how the ethics application process works. I think people are surprised sometimes when there's actually 13 to 15 people in the room at any given application. So it's that level of scrutiny, or that level of detail. Back to that point about legal and Aboriginal, probably work with someone, gain trust, and then justify risk and benefits. Increasingly, we're also worried about risks to researchers. There's something of this in investigating that type of situation, and what would be your exit strategy at that level.
Is there a different body of ethics that sits around working in Aboriginal communities as a discrete
yes.
Demographic? social area, but in relation to those areas. And what I'm getting at here is this presumption that I don't share, that Aboriginal communities ought to be this kind of place
that's locked away,
therefore behind a permit wall, and that permit wall is then reinforced by this sort of this code of silence. And how do we get past that?
What we would do is probably assign an expert like the law faculty person or the lawyer to work with you extensively to really build up a very clear protocol and a very clear. We would often, members of the community volunteer to work with researchers such as yourself to really work it out as safety on both sides, if you will. So that's the best we can do.
But the implication is the notion of self-conscious silence are often for Aboriginal communities, not the rest.
Oh, I wouldn't agree with that, but I think the code of silence that exists there is of a particular type, and it is definitely there. I've had personal experience, but I'm just interested in the sort of the ethical concept within the institution that, you know, we go there on the grounds of consent, because obviously an institution has long-term research interests that it has to maintain, I fully understand, but that's potentially inconsistent with actually finding out what's really going on, since people won't necessarily tell you if it's going to implicate themselves.
Yeah, but that's the role of police and the courts. It's not the role of researchers.
Well, I think that's a different argument. But I'm thinking about the sort of issues that Peter Sutton has raised, and the fact that he spoke that over a number of decades, anthropologists became aware of a lot of problems that were going on in communities, but didn't say anything because they would say, oh, well, I'm here on a certain ethical basis, therefore I just won't say anything. And there are people who will certainly defend that approach. I don't. I've got major problems with it. But I think, how can the police get involved until they become aware of the issue? Well, the researcher has a vital role in disclosing the fact that there's an issue in the first place.
The same is true of a lot of institutions in Australia.
I agree.
So I don't know why you're picking out Aboriginal communities.
Well, just because it's a topic.
Usually now there's a co-seal, isn't there, that other than the written required through the post-school ritual, so you'd have to be very clear in the agreement that you may be required, for instance, in situations of challenges and situations of qualification in court, and that would be able to be very clear and clearly understood so that nothing was disclosed outside of understanding.
We have some last questions at the back, and there's maybe one or two more questions.
It's probably a lot easier and completely unrelated. I'm currently in a research project that's dealing with what I've termed publicly available traditional stories. They're stories they don't mind to be completely broadcast around the planet. And I'm probably going to have to adjust my ethics approval. I noticed that there's a new ethics approval process coming out for minimum risk and standard projects. And there's also these new guidelines coming out. Is this all going to be reasonably seamless with the ethics approvals that have been granted in the past? Or am I going to have to go through the whole process again?
Seamless.
Excellent. Thank you.
Good. I pledge allegiance to faster research ethics, and we're working as hard as we can. The balance is getting that form to be coalesced or represent that national statement. A surprising amount of researchers at the university here don't read the national statement, and they're surprised that we're, in fact, in order to operate, we're linking to the national statement. They're like, the national statement. The other day I was shocked at that. So, but it's really the push to simplify and clarify and get on work. We're very keen to, and also work with people to partnerships and the right level of expertise and care for both sides of this.
Last question.
Just to acknowledge and not just question, but I work with, spend time in central remote communities, but well as urban communities around Melbourne, and found your helpful to think about the work with the Koori's Aboriginal people as cultural, no matter where it is. That makes sense. And so it's about acknowledging that those same kind of considerations work, but just as important engaging with urban.
Absolutely.
Even though it might be done in a different way.
Yeah, I hope I didn't give the impression that there's one set of real Aborigines and one set of...
I think that was great.
Brett,
please join me in taking a break.